I think that science is useful if you, you know, it doesn't really matter what you discover if nobody ever knows about it, right? Like, if you just, you could solve all the world's problems, but if you tell nobody and nobody can understand you, then it's as if you didn't.
Welcome to People Doing Physics, the podcast that explores the personal side of physics at the Cavendish Laboratory at the University of Cambridge. Hello, I'm Jacob Butler from the Outreach Office.
And I'm Vanessa Bismuth, the Communications Manager at the Cavendish.
This month on People Doing Physics, we have a voice very familiar to listeners. Simone Azagire-Barker, PhD student in the Quantum Optical Materials and Systems Group here at the Cavendish. Following a winding path into optical physics, Simone previously dipped her toes into nanotechnology in the Cavendish's NanoDTC and chemical physics at the University of Edinburgh. Her interdisciplinary background builds on her fascination for figuring out how the world works, whether looking at quantum systems or how to structure the perfect argument. Outside of science, Simone has been involved in student magazines, debating clubs, improv theatre and podcasts, most notably, in our opinion, as one of the founding members of this very podcast. She also produces a fortnightly segment for Basque Public Broadcast Radio's Factoria Magazina. In this episode, Simone talks about finding her way through a multidisciplinary career in science, the importance of communication, and how to publish your first academic paper at the age of 16. Stay with us.
So welcome, Simone.
Thank you.
Great to have you.
It's so weird to hear an introduction for myself. Usually it's me giving the introduction.
No, it's great to have you on that side of the table. And it's because you're submitting your thesis, you're writing your thesis, submitting it soon. So you're going to leave us. Boo. So we wanted to give an opportunity for our listeners to know the interviewers. And also an opportunity for us to say thank you for all your very hard work and for being a founding member of that podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
So you know the drill. As with all our guests, we'll start at the beginning, and we want to hear about how you came to physics. Was it always the path for you, or did you find yourself exploring different areas?
I was always really interested in science, but I wasn't like exclusively interested in science. So I think growing up, I don't really remember specifically what, like, I think I was kind of fascinated by, like, oh, like, you know, astrophysics, like, everybody who's like, oh, well, you know, stars in the universe, that's amazing. But I was also really interested in books and in reading about science fiction, like, history, and I also really enjoyed writing. So when I was younger, I wrote a lot of bad poetry. and I just was kind of fascinated by a lot of things and not just, like, how the world works from like a science angle, but also from like a human angle or like a society angle. And so it was really I try to kind of like pursue all those interests kind of simultaneously and not really commit to anything in particular. I mean, you don't really have to as like a high school student, right? Mm. And I was also quite lucky that my parents were very supportive of all the random things I was interested in. I mean, you know, they'd be like, okay, well, here's a book about this, or, and so they really encouraged me to kind of explore all the things that I was interested in. And then it was only really at the last kind of moment in high school where you have to decide, okay, what am I going to do at university? And at that point in school, I'd really enjoyed kind of chemistry, physics, the kind of more molecular physics, or kind of thinking about materials or how like actual things are made and what they're made out of in the world. And I also really liked, yeah, like I said, like writing. At some point I thought, oh, I'll be a detective novel writer or something. and so I thought, okay, well, I probably should do science now because otherwise I'll forget the math. Mm. And then I can always pivot to doing something more humanities based, or, you know, if I want to study history or politics, I can do that later. That seems easier to go in that direction than to forget the math, you know, how to do an integral and then have to go back to doing physics. So I kind of ended up doing physics because I felt like if I didn't do, well, chemical physics, because I didn't want to choose between chemistry and physics, but because if I didn't do it then it would have been harder to do it later.
That's good thinking. Just for the sake of our listeners, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I'm from the Basque Country in Spain, near the border with France, and so I grew up there. But my family moved around a lot when I was younger, so we lived in the US for 3 years. Well, we moved around. I was about 4 years old, so that's why I have a vaguely American accent. Although it kind of changes depending on who I'm talking to. And then we lived in Qatar for 4 years. Wow. Until I was about 12. Then we moved back to Spain in 2009. And then I did my last years of... So then I was in Spain for a bit. And then I did my last years of high school in the UK. And then I went to Scotland for my undergrad. So kind of all over the place.
Right, but your high school years were in the UK.
My last 2 years of high school. But not... Like from 13 to 16, I was in Spain.
You said you did an internship during your last year at high school.
Yeah.
Where was it? And what did you end up doing?
So I was at this point kind of interested in science. And I thought, okay, well, it would be cool to get some experience in seeing if I actually just have a romanticized view or it's actually something I would want to do as a career. And I was really lucky in that. So where I grew up, we would always, even though we were moving around, we would always go back to Spain. To the Basque Country for Christmas and also for like the summer months. So I would always be in the Basque Country during the summer. And there is a lot of research institutes in where I'm from. So I'm from near the city of Donostia or San Sebastian. In the Basque Country, it's quite interesting because I think 20 or 30 years ago, they started investing a lot in kind of setting up research centers. So there's a very dedicated effort from the government to kind of invest in a long-term strategy to make the Basque Country a really good place for doing applied and other types of science. And so, now there's these like world-leading research centers in mainly nanotechnology and material science, theory of material science, nanophotonics, but also like neuroscience and AI. So there was kind of a choice of what subjects to go to kind of focus on and a lot of investment over the years. And so now, at the point where I was about 13 or so, these research centers had been around for, I guess, a few years. And I went to, they just had, an outreach talk. I think it was the Nano Gune Institute, where they did nanotechnology research. And I saw a talk by Javier Espura, who's a theorist, who actually collaborates with some people in Cambridge. At the time, I had no idea who he was. But obviously, he gave a talk about nanophotonics and kind of using plasmonic gold nanoparticles and, you know, how you can put them inside people's bodies and then they go into a tumor and then you shine infrared light through the skin and then the tumor disappears, or I don't know. I'm sure it's a lot more complicated than that, but, you know, this was this outreach talk for 15-year-olds or whatever. And I was just like, wow, this is amazing, nanotechnology, how cool. And that was kind of how I first learned about that field. And I was lucky that I was able to do a research internship in a polymer research center, Polymat, because they hadn't had any interns before. So even though doing internships is very common, like maybe in the US or even the UK, at Spain at the time, like this is more than 10 years ago, like there weren't that many programs for doing internships, especially not as a high school student.
So wait, did you just knock on doors?
So kind of, I just emailed people, and I was lucky that they set up kind of a program, but I was like their pilot student to see like if they would want to be doing it. Thankfully, they kept doing it afterwards, so I think that's a good sign. So it was really cool because I was my last year of high school and I had very basic knowledge of chemistry, but they basically, I spent a month kind of making polymers and these big 2-liter reactors, just putting in all the ingredients and running the same experiment basically as a function of different concentrations of this soap or the surfactant. So they were trying to figure out basically how certain reaction conditions changed the size of the particles that they were forming. And they already had a theory and they just needed somebody to run the same experiment slightly differently, 30 times. So perfect thing for someone to just do, and probably kind of boring if you're a researcher and you don't want to do the same thing over and over again for a month.
But great if you're just trying your hand.
Exactly. I mean, I was wow, this is real science. I can't believe they're letting me do all these experiments, with my lab coat. There were some reactants that you had to keep in the fridge because they were slightly explosive. So I was sometimes you'd have to wear a mask, because the particles were so fine, you wouldn't want to breathe them in and go into a specific. I thought this was amazing. And so that's why I was I became really interested in that.
I dread to think what the risk assessment was like for letting a teenager loose on explosive materials that
you
could inhale.
Actually, thinking about it now, I'm really glad they took that opportunity because I don't know if I would have ended up in nano if I hadn't had those lab experiences. And then, summers after that, they always let me come back, which was very nice because nowhere else I applied would allow me to go. But then they were like, oh, it's fine, Simone, come back. You were good last year. Like, we'll give you a new project.
So you mentioned you went to Edinburgh to study chemical physics for undergrad. What drew you to that course? Anything in particular?
I kind of just didn't want to choose between chemistry and physics. I thought, like, physics, I really enjoyed, like, the more fundamental nature of physics, or the kind of trying to figure out, like, the root equations or laws of what was going on. But at the same time, the kind of physics you do in high school, I didn't find particularly interesting, right? Like, Newtonian physics, you know, maybe it's controversial, but I think it's kind of boring. You know, I don't really care how long the car takes to get from A to B. That's not, like, a fascinating question. And I felt like in chemistry, we were learning about, like, different elements and different, you know, like, chemical reactions, stoichiometry and stuff like that. And I thought that that was just a much more interesting kind of type of thing to be thinking about. But I knew that, like, I just hadn't done the interesting physics yet, right? And we were just doing some basic math. And so I kind of wanted to explore that a bit more at university. And I think Edinburgh was one of the few places that actually had, like, the opportunity to do that and keep doing both. So it was, even though it was chemical physics, for the first couple of years, it was almost like doing a double degree, because you did all the compulsory courses for physics and all the compulsory courses for chemistry. So you had no free time. And then in the next couple of years, you kind of converge towards materials or condensed matter physics and condensed matter, kind of more inorganic chemistry. So the parts that are really the foundation of where all the kind of physics chemistry interactions kind of happen.
That's a chance to explore lots of areas and then specialise.
Yeah, exactly.
And you mentioned you went back to the polymer lab to do placements. Yeah. What sort of things did they have you doing there?
So I think they would just come up with random projects that they were like, oh, it'd be great if someone randomly did this, right? I mean, it wasn't there for a very long time and I didn't have the specialised knowledge. But the second year I was there, I was trying to figure out, basically someone had done their PhD producing these new types of glue, so polymers can be adhesive, and then they wanted to test if they basically how sticky they still were, like, a year after, you know, this person had finished their piece. So kind of looking at the longevity of the properties that she had measured. But so I was doing all these random tests of, you know, how sticky is this piece of paper, which is kind of funny. But then there just wasn't enough samples. So then I had to make a bunch of new polymers. And so I didn't actually end up doing the project that they said. But again, I learned a lot about adhesive polymers, which, of course, 10 years ago, so I've since forgotten. But it was quite fun. And then the year after, because I'd just started learning some code at university, as you know, as you do in your courses, then they put me on some kinetic reaction modeling, which is also kind of interesting to see. So it was just kind of, it was quite interesting to just get to explore random little projects and see a lot of different aspects of how the research was happening. And also because I kept going back to the same place over and over again. At that point, like, I, you know, as the recurring summer student, it kind of almost became a joke that people thought I was a PhD student. I'd just been away and come back because I would know, like, the more senior researchers who had stayed, but whereas, like, someone who had just joined, like, wouldn't know them. And people would always find it really confusing that I seemed to know everybody, even though I was just a summer student that showed up. But it was really nice because it kind of gave me a sense of kind of also, like, the life cycle, right, of a research. Well, I mean, this sounds so weird. It sounds like you're going to die. But like, you know, how people move across an institute and how their role changes, because people who joined when I started maybe, like, had a different, more senior role, like, you know, the third year I was there. So, I mean, and it was really, really just a very nice, supportive environment, and everyone was super friendly. So that's why I was like, oh, you know, science is great. Like, why not work in a lab?
Did that help you choose your specialty? And, you know, you were saying that the first few years are chemistry and physics, and then you kind of specialize.
Yeah.
Does that experience in the polymer lab help you in any way choosing your path?
I think it gave me a lot of insight into all the different types of things that happen in a lab. Like, it was quite a big lab. And I think, even, I mean, obviously I'm not a polymer scientist now. Spoiler alert. But and it wasn't because I didn't find that interesting, but I guess I had already kind of seen that world and I just wanted to do something different. I think it definitely made me realize that I really enjoyed the kind of hands-on aspect of things and actually being in the lab and running experiments and being able to say, okay, next week we're gonna, like, we have this theory, let's test it, let's, you know, change this variable and run the experiment at that point. And and that's kind of what I really like about nanotechnology and nanoscience, is that it happens at a scale where it's kind of, it's in your control to decide what experiments to do to a certain extent. It's not like working on particle physics on an accelerator where you have to submit grants years in advance, wait months for time, then get all this data set. Like, it's a very, those are very, you have a very long life cycle, or like a long time scale at which you can run an experiment versus, you know, I can decide to run an experiment tomorrow and, and then I can do it. It's kind of at a time scale and at a length scale that it's accessible, right? You can kind of do it yourself with your hands. And that's what I really enjoyed about nanotechnology was that it still has so much fundamental research and fundamental science, because at the kind of the nanoscale, you get this, you know, all of the quantum science starts to become relevant. We are at this kind of interdisciplinary new frontier between chemistry, physics, biology, all of those traditional disciplines sort of fuse together. So there's a lot of interesting basic science to be researched, but at the same time, it's very applied. And you can see how that then turns into technology very quickly, or you can imagine it with your, you know, with your brain. You don't have to think about, it's still not that abstract, right? It's not like thinking about fundamental, I don't know, category theory or like string theory or
Where did you find out about, like, how did you discover nanotechnology? Was that in your last year placement?
So it was thanks to this talk that I saw when I was in high school. I don't think I particularly thought then, okay, now I'm going to study nanotechnology. But it was definitely quite, it made kind of put it on my radar.
In your mind.
It was in my, kind of in my mind. And then I sort of went through high school, you know, through university. I did these polymer internships. Then I had the opportunity to spend a year as part of my degree doing like a 12-month research internship. So I thought, okay, like I'm really enjoying science and maybe I want to do a PhD, but I should probably figure out if that's something I want to do. And having the opportunity to spend a year in a lab actually doing research, I thought, okay, well, what a great free trial. You know, if I hate it, I don't have to then do it, you know? And if I love it, well, then I know that I can continue doing it. And it seemed like doing something for a year, like, because it's one thing to do something for a month where you're doing it, but it's not really your project. And, you know, you can just go to the beach afterwards and you're kind of on holiday.
Yeah,
the stakes are much lower.
Yeah.
So I thought doing an internship for a year would give me a good idea of whether or not that was something I would like seriously consider as a career. And so I went to Eindhoven in the Netherlands for a year. And I worked at the Dutch Institute for Fundamental Energy Research, which I wasn't really doing any energy research, but for some reason my group was there. But we were also affiliated with the University of Eindhoven, and it was a nanophotonics group. And that was where I first kind of worked with lasers and optics. And I just really enjoyed it. Like, the postdoc I was working with was really, really nice and really, really mentored me. He went on to become an assistant professor in China after I left. So he was at a stage where he was looking to kind of really kind of take on a more senior role. And he just taught me everything about optics that I could have possibly wanted to know. I didn't really like think about that. Like, when I chose that project, it was more because it kind of had the buzzwords that I was looking for, you know, quantum, like, ooh. And that was as much as I had kind of researched the group. So then when I showed up, and obviously I went into the lab and it had all the mirrors and the lasers, and I thought, oh wow, I'm going to be doing real optics. And it should have been obvious from like the description, but I just hadn't thought about it that much. So I was incredibly lucky, because it could have gone, you know, it could have been horrible. I kind of just kept choosing to do things that I thought in the moment were interesting, and seeing if you just kind of optimizing for the present moment where that took me. And then after that, when I came back to Edinburgh to finish my degree, I did my master's project in a lab where, because you had to do it, it was a really like such a hard year, because you had to do a project, but also all the courses that you didn't do in the year you were abroad, plus the courses for that year. There was so much work that they literally restructured the program after we left, so it's much better now, please. I really do encourage people to do chemical physics at Edinburgh. It's a great program. But yeah, so then I worked in kind of molecular electronics group where we were looking at, it was a really nice interface of all the things I'd been working on, because I was able to work in the lab. So I was synthesizing new molecules, looking at like kind of crystallizing them, looking at their properties in the solid state, their optical properties, so looking at how they interacted with light. And then, so that project kind of took all the little bits of things that I was interested in throughout and mixed them all together. But then during that time, I also realized I was missing, like, being so hands-on in the wet lab, in the chemistry lab, synthesizing, that requires, you end up doing, like, learning a lot about the synthesis mechanisms, and I was more interested in the properties themselves. So I thought, okay, I kind of want to do something a bit more, like, in this intersection, but more on the physics side than on the chemistry side. And that's how I ended up choosing to come to the Nano DTC here, because the CDT program, so the Centres for Doctoral Training in the UK, are just a great way to explore different topics before you commit to one. For your PhD. Because, I mean, I would look at PhD, you know, adverts And they would all sound interesting, but it wasn't like one of them, I was like, wow, this is what I want to do. It was all like, oh, this could be interesting, or like maybe that, like, or this other one. And I kind of, they were all interesting enough, but not like the hill I wanted to die on for 4 years, you know? And so I really just wanted a chance to explore different things. So I came here in 2019, and obviously I got like 5 months of normal Cambridge before the pandemic started. And then started my PhD officially in 2020, October.
Did COVID affect your experience much?
A lot. I mean, even though the lockdown was technically during the master's year of the CDT program, so, you know, I did my master's project, I went back to Spain for the lockdown. That was kind of strange to finish a degree, like, from your bedroom. I mean, you know, we've all had this experience, I don't have to explain it to you. But then starting in 2020, in autumn, even though obviously like a lot of the lockdown rules had lifted, there were still a lot of restrictions in the lab, and so as an experimentalist, you know, you had restrictions on how many people could be in the lab at a given time. There was a lot more wait time for being trained on equipment because just people weren't available or people couldn't physically show you, so it just meant I think that kind of learning happened at a lot slower rate than a much slower pace than it happens now, right, for students who, I mean, for anyone who just shows up and people are there and you can talk to them and you get a lot more of these kind of serendipitous interactions, which I think make up a lot of science. Like, I think the moments that I've made the most progress have been during my PhD have been from random conversations I've had.
Yeah, like, those are so crucial.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Mm. And so it's because often as a PhD student or even as a researcher, you don't really know what you don't know. And it's really from randomly discussing the things that are frustrating you with somebody who's like, oh, wait, have you tried this? Or, oh, actually, you know, don't bother with that. Like, I solved that problem. I had the same problem, you know, a year ago. Here, you should install this update on your computer. Or things like that, right? And there's so much time that, I mean, it wasn't wasted because I was still learning about things. But it just meant that you just were kind of spending a lot of time reinventing the wheel where you didn't really need to. And it definitely was a lot lonelier. And I think a lot of the kind of social cohesiveness of that I know was in my group when I joined. And that was one of the things that made me choose my group, was that the people seemed very friendly and there was a big like social atmosphere. Obviously, like, during COVID, that all sort of disappeared. And I think it took a long time for then all of those, you know, we did lunch outside. I mean, it's actually wild to think about it now, like even when it was snowing, because you couldn't meet indoors.
Yeah.
So you could only meet outdoors, but then we'd all have lunch together outside, like under the... Like, you know, the back of Maxwell Center, there's some bike racks, but they're under, like, there's like a, you know, there's a little roof. So we would eat there when it was snowing because you couldn't be able to eat anywhere else without, it was, yeah, it's really weird to think about it now.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever it takes. Just to have an interaction with somebody.
Yeah, we've all been there. We all, I mean, yeah. But so... After your nano DTC year, you went on to do your PhD. So obviously you like something there in Cambridge. And that you're finishing up just now.
Yes.
So can you give us a quick summary? Mm-hmm. Quick? Of what you've been doing?
Sure. So the group that I joined, the Quantum Optical Materials and Systems group, we look at the quantum material properties of different materials and systems. So basically, our research looks at the materials that could be useful or that show promise for applications in quantum technologies, whether that be for quantum information technology, so things like connecting quantum computers together in the future, or quantum sensing. So that's kind of establishing new types of sensors, whether that's for magnetic field sensing or other types of temperature sensing or other field sensing. At the nanoscale, so new types of applications. And what really I found really interesting about this topic, so I joined to study a material called hexagonal moronitride, and similar to graphene, so you may have heard of graphene, where you have these atomically thin layers that you can kind of peel off into atomically from graphite. And so HBN is also, well, HBN for short, hexagonal boron nitride, that's where the acronym comes from, is also a 2D material, and it's a transparent material, so it's, you know, see-through, although you can't really see it, it's very thin. But it has these defects, so there's crystals, imperfections, impurities, atoms that shouldn't be there. And so there's a whole field, I mean, the field that I'm part of, around these solid state defects in solid state materials and using them for quantum applications. And the kind of state of the art for this is defects in diamond. So actually diamonds, you know how some diamonds are kind of more yellowish or have different colors, and that's because there's imperfections inside the lattice that absorb and emit light. So for example, if you have a yellowish diamonds, they have a lot of nitrogen inside. And so these atomic scale defects are, you can think of them as little molecules, like individual molecules that are trapped inside of this solid state material. So in the case of diamond, but in the case of our material HBN. And it's almost like all the physics that you could do with a particular atom or a quantum dot or a single ion, you can do all these molecules. And instead of having them trapped in a vacuum using lasers and magnets to kind of levitate them, you just have them inside a little rock instead, which is quite convenient. And so a lot of the physics is quite similar in terms of what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand at the fundamental level what's happening to the electrons associated with these defects and trying to control the quantum property associated with them called the spin. And we are interested in quantum optics, so the optical, like the light emitting nature of these materials. And so we use light to kind of interrogate what the quantum properties are. So in my case, we use our lasers to try to understand what the spin properties of these defects are. And the idea is that because these materials have this, you know, can speak quantum, they have a quantum property that you can access and kind of interrogate using light, then all of these different quantum technologies in the future where, you might want to connect two quantum computers together, like you would connect two normal computers together through like fiber optic cables. Or you can have a magnetometer that works at very, very high precision, much better than any other magnetometer that exists right now. And you could put them inside the human body and know what the temperature was because of how certain things changed or things like that. So really high precision atomic scale sensors and also materials that could be useful for kind of quantum information processing. So there are a lot of really cool applications, but fundamentally we're looking at the basic physics of these materials because there's a lot of different candidates for materials that could be useful, and they all have their advantages and disadvantages. And so in my project, we were looking at a new material which has these defects that were only discovered in 2016. We knew that they emitted this light in this particular way. We didn't know if the spin was going to be good. So during my PhD, along with the rest of the team, we discovered, yes, indeed, they have this amazing spin property that we were looking for. And we showed that you could access it in a way that was favorable. And then now we've been looking at kind of the next steps of, okay, well, doing all the kind of benchmarking that you need to do to show that this material is promising for this application.
Going back to what you were saying at the beginning about like doing something in the lab hands-on and being able to, with your brain, think about the potential applications of this. Like, it seems that you found kind of your way around this with this kind of research, isn't it? Where you can actually, I mean, you're looking at fundamentally the properties of one specific material, but you can imagine all the applications that you can have in the real world.
Exactly. And it's kind of weird because as a student, you know, you come into a field. I mean, I didn't know that this field existed until I started my PhD. And even when I started, like, a year later, I was like, wow, I've misunderstood everything. I thought my project was totally different because you don't really know what you don't know until you actually understand it, right? And I think that's super normal. But one of the things was that because we were discovering a lot of, we were doing the first experiments on this stuff, there wasn't really literature to learn from because it was us, right, later. So it's learning, you didn't know, okay, how much of it is just because I don't know how to look up papers, or it was hard to kind of know, you know, all this has been done on different systems. So understanding where to look for information and how to kind of learn the physics while you're learning about the material was kind of a challenge. But I definitely had never worked on something so early in its development. And it's been kind of interesting to work on something that you just literally don't know if it's going to work, or even, you know, what you're looking for, or you know what you hope will happen, but there's no necessarily a guarantee that that's the case. So it's been really rewarding to see that that's sort of paid off, and now there's this really exciting field that, you know, didn't exist 5 years ago. But yeah, it didn't necessarily have to be that way, I guess.
Yeah, exciting times. Now, you mentioned that outside of science, you've been involved in a wide range of journalism and outreach activities. What sort of things did you get up to at Edinburgh?
So at Edinburgh, I joined the science magazine because I was looking for hobbies to have, I guess, as a student. And in the student society fair, I came across the science magazine, and I really enjoyed writing, like I said, when I was growing up. And I thought, okay, like, this sounds interesting. But I couldn't possibly write an article, so I'll be an editor, you know, like correct grammar or something. And then I joined as a copy editor or a sub editor, I don't remember. And then as soon as I started reading first drafts, I thought, okay, no, I could write this. Like, this seems okay. It's other students writing. It's fine. And that's how I kind of got started doing some journalism. I don't know if it's at the standard that you would call like real journalism at that time, but writing articles about kind of scientific news. And doing a lot of editing. And then in my final year, I was editor-in-chief of the magazine. And that was actually a lot more work than I expected going in.
Because just adding to the pile of work.
I know. I keep making decisions where I keep, you know, like the podcast. I keep saying yes to things. And then I'm like, how am I going to get this done? But it all works out in the end. But yeah, I mean, because it was, you know, we had about 30 authors per issue, like 15 illustrators, like a 12-person committee. Like, it was a lot of things to keep track of. But I learned a lot, and I really enjoyed it, and it was really rewarding to do. And I think that, you know, I only joined because I was interested in kind of seeing that world a bit, and that's kind of been the recurring theme throughout, I guess, my career. It's so weird to call it a career.
It's definitely a career now.
Yeah, I guess. But just kind of seeing what you like and doing more of it, and then seeing where that takes you, and then that always ends up opening more doors.
You talked as well about getting involved in debating and finding that there was a sort of lot of similarities or useful aspects of that you have later applied to science.
Yeah, so in Edinburgh, I also got involved in the debating club, which was really fun. Everyone was super friendly, and it was just a really kind of supportive and fun environment to learn how to make arguments and just argue with your friends on a weekly basis. But I mean, that was kind of what fueled the humanities side of things, I guess. I still really wanted to... Like, I really enjoy science, but I like to think about things in context and the wider implications of technology and how that affects policy and our lives, like, on a day-to-day. And that was really interesting. And learning how to construct arguments and how to convey them in a coherent fashion and in a way that is convincing is really hard, obviously. So it was super, super useful to, have had that training. Because it is really, I mean, it's kind of like constructing... Whether you're a lawyer, you're arguing with someone, or you're constructing an experiment, or writing a news article, right? You have a message that you're trying to convey, and there's going to be the most important things about your message that you want to get across as clearly as possible, and those are the things that you want to focus on. And then you can think about, okay, well, what supporting evidence do I need to convince somebody about this? Whether it's, you know, whether they should give you a grant, or whether they should publish your paper, or whether they, you know, should just believe that your results are true, right? Or you want to make a claim about, you know, your scientific system, well, you need to have the evidence to prove it. So I think thinking about things in that kind of analytical way, definitely, I mean, it's not why I joined, right? I just joined because I was having fun. But it had a huge payoff in being part of the club for 4 years. Then I realized, like, actually my, like, analytical skills got so much better because you're, even when you're, like, hearing somebody talk, you're waiting for them to tell you, okay, but why do I care about this? Or what is the impact of this? And so I just got much better at, like, thinking more analytically, for sure.
So, yeah, anyone listening, if you have a debate club in your high school or university, join. It's really useful. And you kept most of those activities when you moved up to Cambridge, down to Cambridge. But you also added improv theater to that.
So, I mean, I didn't keep doing everything. I stopped doing the debating. I stopped doing the magazine. Well, I joined the Cambridge Science Magazine, but on their podcast, because I thought, okay, I've done enough writing. You know, maybe it'd be cool to do a different format, because I still was interested in the outreach stuff. And so I emailed to ask to be, because they already had a podcast that had a few episodes, but the podcast team had graduated. So then they were like, okay, you are now the team. And I thought, okay, cool, I'll figure it out. But then another PhD student also wanted to join, so we kind of figured it out together, Ruby Coates, who kind of relaunched that the Blue Side podcast with me. And that was really fun. We definitely... We're too ambitious with it. We decided to do it every 2 weeks, which is way too often. It was so much work, but it was really fun. And again, like, it kind of gave me the practical moments to learn stuff, right? You can learn stuff in theory, but trying it out. And it's really good to try things out in a kind of low-stakes environment, right? Like writing an article for your student magazine, writing up, like, doing a podcast for your student podcast. You can do the thing, but if you get it wrong, it's fine, right? Like, it's not... Yeah. No one's actually paying you to do it. And it's okay if only two people listen. And I think that the improv as well, like, it was a bit random. There was just a free improv theater course in the beginning of January 2020 for scientists to, like, learn how to communicate. And I thought, okay, that sounds fun. And it was really fun to just get to be ridiculous for 2 hours every Wednesday until the pandemic. And I just really enjoyed it. And again, it was a situation where it just taught me about communicating in a different way. And they're the storytelling, especially, because if you have ever watched improvised theater, I mean, you know, people are coming up with stuff on the spot. So they really have to very quickly decide what the scene is about, build a character that is entertaining or convincing or has some kind of personality, and then figure out very quickly what the scene is about and actually tell you a convincing story. So there again, it was just a different way of learning how to, yeah, convey ideas, I guess, and what makes something gripping and what doesn't.
So it sounds like you sort out a lot of opportunities to communicate in different ways with different people. How, if at all, do you think this has helped your scientific work?
I think that, you know, science is useful if you... You know, it doesn't really matter what you discover if nobody ever knows about it, right? Like, if you just... You could solve all the world's problems, but if you tell nobody and nobody can understand you, then it's as if you didn't. And so I think that, you know, science is all about communicating. We communicate with collaborators. We communicate through journals. You hope that if you're working in applied science, that your technology will have some use, that somebody will turn into something useful. Or if you're working on something very fundamental, well, then that people will understand the mysteries of the universe and that'll be super fulfilling and, you know, you'll get the Nobel Prize or something. But none of that will happen if nobody understands the science that you're doing. And I think along the way as well, like learning how to, like it helps you to understand what other people are saying. So that's something that, especially doing all the interviewing with the podcast, I was writing my CV late recently and it's actually, like, we've interviewed so many people. And learning how to talk to people and actually... like ask the right questions to get them to tell you the information that you need from them, again, is like having that kind of interrogation skill. It's something you only learn with practice, but is also very useful when you're talking to people from different fields, because often you have to phrase things in slightly different ways, especially when you're working in a multidisciplinary context. And so I think that if I hadn't had all this random, you know, just these random hobbies that I, you know, I did because I enjoyed them, but they definitely have been super rewarding and just allowing me to, yeah, just... work in many different contexts and have to communicate in many different ways and take the nuggets of that to then be able to apply them. And even for, I mean, improv, I've kind of lost any shame in front of an audience because, I mean, I've been so ridiculous and people have paid to see me be ridiculous. So I can't be, you know, at least it's entertaining. And so it's like, if I have to give a talk and it goes badly, it's like, okay, well, you know, next time it'll be fine. And you kind of learn to deal with that, like to take more risks, I guess. And I think that that's something that really pays off in science, right? I mean, a PhD is a very, like, long and difficult process. And I think that, you know, the resilience that you build through that as well, like the PhD has, okay, I've developed a lot of, sure, there's been some science that's come along the way, but the PhD has mainly just taught me about myself. And that'll be the thing that's really rewarding, I guess.
So this seems to be lots of things you've sought out yourself through personal interest. Do you think there's enough support for scientists or enough focus on this in sort of scientific courses to make sure that even people that wouldn't naturally approach those things are given those skills?
I think that there are opportunities. Like, I think, especially when you're an undergraduate student, right, there's so many societies, you have this momentum to kind of find a group of people that like doing something similar and get it done. And I think universities, at least in the UK, have funding for that sort of thing. I think later on, as you kind of progress in your career, it becomes harder and harder because those are not necessarily the metrics that you get rewarded on if you're pursuing an academic career. It's not like, okay, well, how many podcasts did you host, right? Like, that's not a metric on anyone's criteria to give you a grant. And so even though all those skills are transferable and help you be a better scientist, they're not doing those activities doesn't directly have like a immediate professional benefit that you can like tangibly see, right? It might be more serendipitous that you might meet someone, I don't know, that is good to network with. And so I think that there isn't necessarily the support, or I think it's changing. Like, people are, you know, there's prizes for, I don't know, people who do outreach, or there's specific grants to support with that. And I think there's a recognition that it's a good thing, but I don't think the system necessarily gives you tangible value in terms of career progression in that direct way, I guess. There's more indirect benefits. And I think that it's also something that, yeah, has to be a lot from your own initiative. And I think there's also like a sense that it has to be professional, right? Like, I didn't join improv because I wanted to be a professional improviser. I mean, I'm not a professional improviser. And I didn't, you know, join the science magazine because I wanted to be a professional journalist. It's not that I wouldn't go into journalism, it's just that wasn't like what I thought when I joined. So I think nowadays there's a lot of pressure to like turn your hobbies into something monetary, or and I think like it's okay to just pursue things like for the sake of them. The Cavendish has a really good, you on the communications side, you've made a really good series of videos, I think, on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube or whatever, of the various hobbies that people have in the Cavendish and how they integrate with physics as well. And I think it's important to remember that like scientists can also just be people who have interests that, okay, may or may not be useful, but you know, doing sports also helps you become resilient. That's useful in any career. And so there's always going to be those benefits that are indirect. But yeah.
So where do you want to tell, do you know where you're, what you want to do after your PhD, or where you want to, like, do you want to become an improv comedian? And do you want to tell us a little bit about where the future might take you?
Sure. I mean, don't expect me on any improv show anytime soon. I'm not announcing my Netflix special, no. I don't know. I think that I definitely really like the world of science. I think science is a really powerful tool and really, you know, I really enjoy the research aspect. But I think that I also, like, you know, it's probably clear from this conversation, I really like the impact of science as well, and thinking about how you turn things from things that are in the lab to things that are, you know, really impactful technologies that actually benefit our daily lives. But also, you know, thinking about the context in which that happens, like what kind of regulation does there need to be for things to actually be impactful, but not like impactful in a bad way, right? And then what are the social conditions that allow you to, I mean, most of science is publicly funded, right? So mm-hmm. is there, what does that mean, right? What responsibilities do we have as the scientific community to the wider public, because we're using taxpayer funds to fund, you know, research? And so there's all of these things that, where science, I think science gets talked about in like a very objective way of like, you know, the science is true, or the science is, you know, looking at facts and whatever. And yes, of course, there's a lot of, it's a very evidence-based discipline, but it doesn't happen some of it happens in a vacuum if you're looking at vacuum physics, but it doesn't happen outside of context, right? And so I think that it's important not to remember that we're not, like, as a scientific community, isolated from the rest of the world. And I think I'm really interested in exploring kind of those intersections of science with industry of science, with policy of science, with people. And so I just hope to, yeah, I'll probably just continue this local optimization approach to a career and see where that takes me, but definitely in exploring those questions further.
Excellent. Watch this space.
Yeah. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Simone. It was great to have you on this side of the table this time. Thank you again very much for all your hard work in the team. And all the best for the next few months.
Thank you. And thanks for inviting me to be a part of it at the beginning. this has also given me so many opportunities as well, having been on this podcast. So I think that, you know, and again, that's not why I joined, right? I joined because I thought it would be fun. So I think, yeah, if you can say yes to things without knowing what the end goal is, it's fine to explore.
Well, thank you to Simone for joining us today. As always, if you'd like to learn more about what we discussed in this episode and more generally about our work at the Cavendish Laboratory, please have a look at the show notes or go to our website, www.phy.cam.ac.uk. If you have any questions you would like to ask our physicists, head to social media and tag us with the hashtag people doing physics. As always, this episode was recorded and edited by Chris Brock. Thank you for listening to People Doing Physics, and we'll be back next month. And thank you very much, and farewell to Simone. It's been great having you on the team.